is very important that we know where our heritage came from. This morning, we've been blessed with some people being here that can carry that history and tell us about that history today. We've asked three people to come up, Bill B., Betty K., and Cindy D. We've got a table up here, and we're going to ask each one of them to share individually a brief history, and then we will open the floor up for any questions. So if you will kindly come on up, and when we get together, we'll have a table.
Hi, my name's Bill. I'm an addict. I don't know what the hell I'm going to say, right? The history. Last night when I was listening to Father Egan talk, you know, it was really quite enlightening even to myself because, well, even before he spoke, I guess Donnie was up there reading these 13 steps, and for many years I've been sharing off and on about when I first came to NA in a federal penitentiary, that they used to have two podiums, one the alkies would get up at, and the other was the narcos would get up on the, and alkies had 12 steps and we had 13 steps, and maybe we kind of knew what was happening from the beginning. I think we still got 13 steps around. But, but in a different sort of way. And I really realized last night that I'm very lucky. You know, I mean, I'm kind of a crossover from that and those endeavors that were destined to fail. And I'm forever grateful to Jimmy Kennan for having the foresight to put Narcotics Anonymous together in such a manner that it embraced the 12 traditions. Otherwise, I'm quite sure that I would be out there amongst that passing parade, probably dead today, because I am one of those addicts that dedicated my life to the use of drugs. And the little white pamphlet where it talks about, well, and I guess all our literature now, it talks about very simply an addict as a man or woman that uses to live and lives to use. Things bobbing up and down here.
Yeah. I was waiting for your head to start going with it.
Is that it? It's all a plot, you understand. So, where in the hell was I? You guys have to pick me up, man. But I'm in Alabama. Well, I don't know how I got here either.
Now you can hear him.
All right. I'm sure you can hear me anyway. I have a big loud voice, you know. Where the hell did I leave off? Oh yeah, Jimmy K. and the 12 traditions, right? And once again, I had found myself incarcerated, and I heard the steps another way. But you know, I'm one of those real hard-headed people. I didn't get the message right away. And I'm kind of thinking about, I guess I've been told I'm supposed to speak tonight, so I'm trying to, you know, some of this probably will come out again in my personal story, but right now we're trying to zero in on the history
Unfortunately, I've been around so long that they kind of run together, you know. Believe it or not, I remember when I had color in my hair, you know, like if I look out here and I see all these people with their light brown hair, and I'm kind of envious, you know. I wonder where in the hell all the years went, but I'm very grateful for each and every one of them, although they embraced a lot of pain, you know, in those growing years. And I was real fortunate to be asked to go to Pennsylvania to the last thing, and there I found out I'd been around 3 years longer than Bob Barrett. And then I come to this thing and find out I was around even 2 years longer than that. You know, I go to Jesus, you know, pardon me, Father. But it's getting to be a revolting development here. You know? I look at the young girls and they don't look back, you know. And that was one of the primary attractions when I came around, you know. So, anyway, here we are doing history, and I guess when I first came around, you know, there wasn't hardly any meetings. There wasn't as many people in the entire fellowship as that are sitting in this room. And had to drive a long distance to go to meetings, about 50 miles, and I was 50 miles back. Nowadays, I see the newcomers, and hell, they don't even want to go 6 blocks across town. You know, they'll sell out and go to an AA meeting because it's around a corner, you know. Well, I don't understand that, because I think they have that thing that says if you're willing to go to any lengths. And that's what happened. We went to any lengths, and we went around town, and the father was talking last night about it being illegal to be an addict, and that's the way it was. And we used to have hideout meetings, and they were announced at the end of a meeting that we would meet at so-and-so's house next week, except we'd all get on the phone and change the meeting place, because the police were around watching things. Jimmy Kennan, once again, was one of the people that insisted that we go to the police department and tell them that we were there, and consequently we became under no surveillance, and that again was in this little white book. We were under no surveillance at any time, and then you found that the addicts began to eat their way out of the woodwork to come in meetings and investigate and see what it was all about. But I was probably one of those kind of like really seedy people that the father was talking about last night, you know. And I don't know, my head was pretty juiced up, you know. I mean, I was a real garbage can addict. Primarily heroin became my first love, but anything else that came along, you know, didn't make any. If it was a chemical, if they told me it was dog shit, I been busy sniffing, you know. And so I was just that kind of person, and my mind was very warped. I mean, I came in, I heard all the words. I mean, I heard them. They said, easy does it, you know, and I thought that meant you didn't have to rush things, you know. You could use on weekends. And so, you know, consequently, it took me about 11 or 12 years before I was around a program for about a dozen years, and then this guy told me, hey, this is a program of total abstinence, you know. And I distinctly remember telling him, well, what's that? He said, you don't use anything, you know. And I thought that was pretty amazing, you know. I mean, how do you not use anything? And so, you know, it's awfully easy for me to take for granted, because as I look back and think about things that were really insignificant, they probably were and are very important to you in your history, you know. kind of like when the H&I began to take place and we started going into, different penitentiaries and carrying the message, those kind of things. And it's, I wish I really knew how to do this thing I'm trying to do here today, some kind of a chronological order. It all sounds so easy to say, well, gee, we used to have 50 people and now we got 100, and then they got crazy and had a conference and somewhere in the middle of the state of California, and there was a lot of arguing. There was a NA tree that had been written up and a set of trustees, one of which I had been asked to be a few years before. And we had these little committees set up, you two guys here, you check over the literature, and if it sounds all right, we'll tell the other six guys, and we'll see if they think it's all right, too, and then we were elected by the fellowship. So it's always been that, what you call the group conscience kind of a thing. And it's kind of the same thing that's going down now, like I was reading this little yellow thing that's probably somebody's private enterprise or something. It was said something in there about the strife of the fellowship, questioning the other part of the fellowship. That's been there from the very beginning, I mean, you get a bunch of strong ego mania people like ourselves, and you'll sit down in the name of group conscience to do something based on your own thoughts of what's right or wrong or needs to be happening. And the minute you do it, then you're criticized by those that are too lazy to do it, right? So it's kind of a strange phenomenon, but I think it's existed from the beginning all the way to now. And truly, there has to be a loving God that's embraced in our fellowship, or we would have divided and fallen a long time ago, with our idiosyncrasies. The thing that I was excited about when I went to Philadelphia a month or so ago is that some people owned up to the fact that they had been part of a conspiracy against the founder of our organization, and that there had been some impure motivations, and it appeared that they were sorry, so there's no use beating a dead horse. We move on from there. Father explained it pretty good last night when he said, hey, there was something going on before, but that we have our own organization that was refounded, and that's what we have to base it on. We have to base it on the fact that, yes, we did have a founder. We had a guy that was interested enough to go around and check all these other things out. And I remember talking to Jimmy, and he was telling how he went to see these people at Addicts Anonymous and Tender Loving Care, and checking it all out, and how he felt that without traditions, the program was destined to fail. So it was really strange, because I kind of felt when we were there, there were some people that were kind of trying to negate the fact that we had a founder, and it would be pretty strange if we had to go back 200 years ago and say, well, our founder was the guy that started the Wastonians, or that they were the head of the board of directors of the Salvation Army, or, because that just really wasn't the way it was. We do have a founder who was fairly recognized at this last conference, and hopefully we'll all go out of here knowing what the score is this time, and that there won't be any self-perpetuation of personal need of not being, I don't want to say this, but well, they were already exposed, right? So that's it. I really enjoy what's going on here. You know, it's like everybody's gathering in all their little papers and minutes, and I can see this terrific book coming forth, probably synonymous with AA as AA comes of age, you know. And I hate to mention that other group, but unfortunately we didn't have any literature in those days. But when I read those things, they certainly became part of my personal recovery, you know. So I'm looking forward to these same kinds of literature being available for our organization to help perpetuate recovery. You guys have been exploring this for obviously a period of time. And I think probably the best way I can serve you is to maybe try to answer questions, and I may or may not have the answer, but there's a few of us other dinosaurs working around somewhere out there on the coast. Not a hell of a lot of us, you understand, but if there's not an answer that I have for you today, I can certainly try to help you find that answer, just like what you're trying to do now, you know. So I don't know how you want to really proceed on, but I feel like I need to turn the microphone over. I think I need to try to answer specific questions that people may want to ask, because you have spent a lot of time in investigating and doing all these things, and I would feel very badly if I just ate all your time up, not being able to help you and assist you in your job by answering your questions, you know. Because I do have a big mouth, I can talk forever.
Floor is open for any questions, Phil. If you do have any, please come forward.
I'm Ken, I'm an addict.
Hi, Ken.
What I kind of was wondering about was, you know, how we got a conference up and how we got that voting structure, because from what I understand, there wasn't really that many regions, and like, who established it and established the voting structure? And what I understand is that it was established and it sort of became accepted and the tree validated it. So I like to, like, you know, who sat down and said, let's have a conference, and the original participants and established the voting structure we have there, which was, what, mid-70s or something? I don't know.
Yeah, the best of my recollection of how that happened is that Jimmy had some ideas, and Greg Pierce was a pretty good writer, and they sat down and they devised this thing called the NA tree. Then it was brought to the Board of Trustees, like we said, in the group conscience, because that's the only place where they had a literature approval thing. And the main thing we wanted to make sure is that no traditions were being violated. In this document was provided an element of change. I mean, just like right now what's happening in the structure, there is an element of change. And if the people utilize the element of change that's there, they can change anything and everything that people are disgruntled about. But at this particular time, fact is, I guess this was about the beginning of the conspiracy, right? Some people had some aspirations that maybe there was going to be a formation and a real organization within the organization. In other words, a World Service Office would be incorporated, that somebody could get a job and be paid, and I'm not talking about Jimmy, I'm talking about the other guy. And so we had this conference going between Northern California and Southern California, and you got to understand that this document had already been voted on and passed, and for some reason, this individual wanted to take it all out to the people. Well, I'll tell you the reason why. It was because it was already told that, no, you can't be the head cheese. And so I wanted to go out and take it through the fellowship. And then began about 3, 4, 5 years of total insanity. Everybody's running around with this book and everybody's voting. Just got really super crazy, you know. Until finally it got voted on, and then came the first conference. And I guess the first few years, it was really more of an odyssey than anything, you know. After that, it got very strange, you know. I mean, it's like people were telling me, I'm a warrior. Warrior. Jesus Christ. Warrior. We're taking shields and swords, and we're going to dissect and castrate each other at the level of this conference. I mean, it was the most absurd thing that I saw, you know. And I saw little groups that were banding together, and they were trying to do these whole little power things, you know. Really didn't set well with me, you know. And I guess one of the things, I had a very controversial reputation, because I've always been the kind of person who just lay it out on the table and you know, tell the truth. So what I did is I couldn't believe all this stuff was happening, you know, even at the level of the Board of Trustees. So I got my little spy recorder, and I went and got everybody on the phone, made about 20 phone calls, and taped everybody, you know. And then we went to the next, and then we went to the next conference, and they were slinging their shit, and I told them, oh yeah? If anybody's interested in listening to these tapes, here they are, you know, right? And then I kind of did something like I said, well, I refuse to do business with deceit and dishonesty. And I retired off the Board of Trustees. I did stay on the board of the World Service Office at that time. And there were some things that became very disgruntling there. Start feeling like I should start carrying a baseball bat and start killing some people. So, you know, I thought, once again, I think, well, you know, I'll just resign. And that's a little bit of that. And of course, the voting structure and everything just came along with the conference. And it's been a very interesting play. I mean, you know, Jimmy Kennan was one of the first people to tell you, hey, we can have all the adversity and all the confrontation we want at the level of our own fellowship. It's just not, we don't take it outside, you know. And when you really consider that you have a room full or a world full of addicts now that are all willing to sit down and talk about that, I mean, isn't it really so much different than what we used to do in the streets, you know? I mean, it's a miracle that we can come and be political, you know. So I don't know if that answered your question, but anything else that...
In our IPs, and I believe in our split form basic text, there was the letter C-A-R-E-N-A, and I called it Karina. Would you elaborate, please, where, if it's an acronym, or was it a thing, or please elaborate on that.
Well, Karina, I believe, was actually copyrighted. And, you know, Betty, was that an acronym of, you know, all I remember is Jimmy saying Karina, Karina for 100 years, you know.
That ought to sound good on the tape.
It's been a while since I've really said what Karina means, so I'm not even sure myself, because I've just said Karina so much myself. But I have all those papers and explaining all that stuff already, so I mean, if there's any kind of, you know, need to know, you know, sometime in the future, I'm in hopes that somehow or the other, these papers that I have will clear up a lot of questions like dates and names and et cetera, you know, because not everything is hacked, okay? Okay, and Karina was copyrighted, I mean, it's a... I'm kidding, it was. It's still.
Any more questions for Bill?
I've never done this before. Hi, Bill. I'm Fran, and I'm an addict and an alcoholic. And I've never heard of Jimmy Kay myself until I just came to the conference. And I was just wondering why, I know we have so many bumper stickers, you know, with different sayings and stuff on it, why nobody in NA has ever thought of a bumper sticker that says, I'm a friend of Jimmy Kay. Just like NA has, I'm a friend of Bill W.
Believe it or not, I think Betty sports one on the back of her car.
I do.
Yeah, but there should be more. I mean, I see all the bumper stickers back there. And you got to understand that this little conspiracy that was going on, it seemed to be a need for some people to actually try to perpetuate the idea that we didn't have a founder in order to cover up their own exposure. But the exposure is exposed, and it really doesn't amount to a hill of beans now. And you know how many hundreds, maybe thousands of people through the last few years that have walked up and asked me the same question as you have. That's why the exposure, that's why probably this group is, that's probably why all these endeavors for the need of NA history to come out has come about. So maybe God's really running this show, you know what I mean, right? So maybe that's the way it had to happen in order to make it all really come out. And that might sound a little esoterical to everybody, but I do believe in God, and I believe He moves in mysterious ways.
Hi, Bill. I'm Fred. I'm an addict.
Hi, Fred.
I have a question. You know, I've seen, like, you know, mainly I've heard about, like, the first little beige thing that ended up turning into the white book. And you mentioned briefly the literature process and being like group conscience, and that's how the literature process happened. I was wondering if you can expand on how we got the beige book and then the white book and the literature process, how it happened there, since you had NA there longer and you would know.
Well, you know, the little beige book, you know, came out of an effort of a few people. The little white book really kind of caused a furor, and it may have been somewhat of, you know, what started the original controversy, so to speak, you know. You know, Jimmy was always begging people, you know, to come and to help. And so, you know, a little beige book had, I don't know, a couple of three, four pages, and it was very thin, flimsy old thing. I mean, obviously there was a need that we have a little more. And which, by the way, this little book right here saved my ass. Because when I finally found out that this was a program of total abstinence and there wasn't anything else, as quiet as it's kept, all about all the other literature, the only thing you really need, and that's why it was very upsetting to me, to more or less see the passing of this particular item right here, this little white book of Narcotics Anonymous, because I used to call it a hip pocket program. I mean, everywhere I went, you know, you found me in a coffee shop, man, I was reading this sucker, you know, because I had gotten down to the point a long time. The fact is, if they had gave me a basic text to start with, I probably never would have made it, you know. But the fact I could sit down, I could handle a paragraph or two at a time. And, I mean, it was a fantastic thing. But anyway, Jimmy was always begging everybody to come over and help out. Well, it got to the point where it was basically done. People wouldn't respond, and it was going on into months and turning into years. Just the hell with it. He finished it, you know, and put it out. Well, that upset the Magdalenos a lot, you know. And therein became the first feud, you know. Why, that son of a bitch. And then immediately there was two camps, you know. But had he not, I probably, like I said, in that crossover thing, and in my insanity, I probably wouldn't be alive today. We'd probably, if, in other words, if we were had to wait for them, we'd probably still be waiting, you know. And that's what happened with that part of it, you know. And, of course, as it grew, the imminent need for us to have our own book and to be our own fellowship and not kind of be the bastard child of AA, you know. We really did have to get together and write our own book, you know.
By own addict, then Joe. So I wonder if you could like expand a little bit on what happened, how the office went from a volunteer thing that it was to the business that it is now, and what the feeling was at the time, and like maybe some more detail, and how we like to turn everything over to them as far as a literature like that.
So, sure. Well, like I told you, at this time when we were talking about this, we were operating as we had like what we call a mother group. But we had these two or three little meetings, and then actually one of the meetings was proclaimed to be the mother group, and therein they had like a little business meeting, conducted business, and for the largest part it was all about talking trash, and anything that got done was done over at Jimmy's house. And Jimmy then became very ill with tuberculosis, but he didn't. I mean, everybody thought he just had emphysema. You know, you'd see the poor guy cough, he'd take three steps forward and two back, and I mean, it was an adventure. I remember he used to come over to my barber shop, and I watched him coming in. And I think, shit, man, is he gonna make it in the door? You know, right? But eventually he wound up under treatment and hospitalization. In those days, they used to take people and put them in, what do you call it? Yeah, it was a sanitarium. But during that period of time, everything wound up in Bob Barrett, trunk of Bob Barrett's car. And so then anything you wanted to know, you tried to catch Bob after a meeting, and maybe he'd look in the trunk, maybe he wouldn't, you know. Most of the time he would, you know. So then Jimmy had a pretty much of a physical recovery, and he came out, and that was kind of like a rebirth for everything, you know. I think he had a lot of time to think while he was in there, you know, and he used to sneak out the window to go to meetings. I remember quite well, and he climbed out the window, and I took him in the car over to some meetings close by. He had a lot of time to think, so there was some redirection, and then obviously everything just started happening in this little back room or side room over at Jimmy's house, and then as the progression went, we had to eventually rent an office. Along about all this time, the tree and all these other things were being born, and the trustees were in effect, and so I became aware of the fact we had to go rent a building, and a board of directors was formed, and the World Service Office was incorporated. It's the same way that AA's World Service Office was incorporated. And then Jimmy was functioning as just kind of like the volunteer manager. All business decisions he put to the board. The board made the vote. So once again, it was the group conscience running this office, and they were trying to the very best of their ability. But all of us that were on the board, we all had our own lives as well. You know, I was running some other kind of a program, and we had a real estate van, and the list goes on. And so there he was, still stuck. Now he had an office that was paid for, but he's still begging people to come over and stuff envelopes. And, you know, people would call in for literature, write in for literature, and people would call from Australia. So in the middle of trying to pack a package of literature, he wound up with a three-hour conversation trying to save somebody's ass from Montgomery, Alabama or somewhere, you know, right? And our... I know Billy Allen tells me how they used to talk, you know what I mean, in the old days. So, you know, I mean, there just wasn't enough hours to go around, but this is when that conspiracy happened, and so they're talking about this senile old man that couldn't even lick a stamp and mail a letter, you know what I mean, which was the most absurd thing in the world, but how do you expect people that are clear across a continent to know? And all I knew is, hey, we got problems, and so eventually the conspiracy went to the effect where they locked him out of the office, and he went there one day and he was locked out of the office. And I'm a firm believer that that took probably five additional years off of his life, because he was a very sick man. He was a very brave man and a very proud man. So if you weren't close to him, you didn't know about that hurt. You know, you would see him. But if you were close to him, you knew that the death-dealing blow had been dealt to him. You know what I mean? And his life just ebbed away, and that's probably why some people in PA came and said, I really didn't mean to hurt anybody, you know. And but, it, you know, who knows? I mean, sometimes you're driving your car, and you really might not mean to run over that kid as you go around the corner, but if you squish him, you squish him. You know, that's the way life is. So during all this period of time, the office was taken over and had a board of directors. They hired another director. The book came about that time, so there was a few bucks floating around. And that's kind of like the transitional thing to what you have today. The board of directors and their executive director, administrator, what the hell ever you want to call them, you know, they run the store like a business, and due to us buying our books and our literature and everything like that from them, it's turned into a full-blown business office. And I don't know whether that's good or bad. It's certainly their functioning as And I do believe that as a fellowship, we do have a right to demand satisfaction. We do have a right to demand accounting. And we do have a right to demand, you know, adequate service from them if we're going to use them. Does that kind of explain that transition?
We got 45 more minutes, and then we need to go to lunch. If we could just open up the floor, Danny, if there's anything to share, all our questions, make that the last issue here.
Hello, Steady, I'm an addict. I hate to see him walk away. He wanted to ask a question. You wanted to ask a question?
Yes.
Come on.
Hi, Leonard. I have a question about a friend of mine has spoken with you before at some convention. He said something about there were some accusations made that part of our fellowship was involved in embezzling some money, and that's where the split came and all this other crap. And I want to know, like, more. I want to hear from the voice of my phone and know more about what all that crap was about.
Okay. What happened was there was a paper strike, for one thing, and so it was hard to be in the shop. The money that you're talking about was, I believe it was like $10,000, was what was supposed to have been, I can say. And our printer that we had for 2 years went bankrupt, and he had our money. And so naturally, this gave fuel to these people that had fuel to the people that Bill was talking about, that, you know, just went out that, oh, we got all this money's gone, and look what happened, look what the office did, you know. And so actually what happened, that money was made up. You know, that was never told. In fact, the one woman who was involved in helping with the binding and et cetera, in business, she asked me, please don't use her name, because she felt that, you know, she did not want to be involved in that, but she said she had made up for that much more. But mainly, Jimmy made up for that in many ways. In many, many ways. And he made sure that that money was paid back. In fact, in 1983, Jimmy said he got off the elevator in New York, and someone from California, that's right, said to him, and who we had known for years, said to him, well, old man, you, and real loud, he said this. He said, you stole $10,000 from the fellowship, didn't you? And Jimmy said to me when he got home, he said, I couldn't believe it. He said, it just never seems to stop. But that was because...
Can I address something to that?
Someone went bankrupt.
Yeah.
I think I can explain that a little better because I was on the board of directors at that time. I think we were the possessor of $10,000. $4,000 was taken to a printer by Chuck Gates and Phil Perez. And they didn't check on the printer, and the printer went south, right? So what happened is this, right? And this is one of the reasons why I resigned off of the board of directors shortly thereafter, that I became really pissed. And I demanded that one guy was working real estate and the other guy was kind of a supervisor at a factory. And I was demanding that these people make good for that money. But we have a forgiving fellowship, you know what I mean? So everybody took a vote, and they said, no, it's not their fault. And they didn't make them pay that back. So as Betty says, Jimmy in his own way found a way to replenish that and make that up. And something else that happened at that period that was real weird, we were talking about the monies. The people in the north of California had some kind of a convention, and they raised about an equal amount of money for the book. And they refused to send that money to the world office, and they sent it down here to the south somewhere, never more to be heard of, right?